literature. You don't get material from our point of view that speaks from for us. And I'm saying, you as students, you to be a student, you have to study, have sources of information from as wide an angle, and make your own independent opinion. Let's see, if, and even here, when you bring a speaker, you want to know, what's their biographical data? You know, what have they studied? What have they done? So it still fit into the same set of censorship of who is eligible to be an informant to us.
Questions that are maybe sort of related to this.
But first, the complaint about South Africa has always been whites are in control, whites are the ones who are ruling, whites are the source of oppression. So one way was to color the apartheid, that you cannot say now we only have an all-white government. So they, the whites themselves, dictated, planned, you know, within the people that are labeled, you know, Asians and people that are labeled colored, that will have so many to form a mini, you know, a parliament that will still be subservient to an all-white parliament. So the idea was also to divide, and because the people that are oppressed in South Africa, who do not have the political elected power, have rallied around one name, which is blackness, which is a political statement. So the Asians, the Indians, the Africans have always worked together, because even though they have a more and more privileged base of color, they are all oppressed, they don't have the same vote, they have some of the same group errors, you name it. And this solidity, has they have been trying many times to break it down. So one way, you know, to bring in divide and rule within them was to draw this, hoping that we would divide and fight amongst ourselves. So this has not really divided the people. It has made the people to look at this issue differently. And of course, as individuals, we have different levels of resistance to temptations. You know, and the same way we have individuals who say, maybe half a loaf is better than no loaf. You know, we might do something over there. You know, it's not that they accept the system. So this is the setup, but the main thing is that there is growing opposition to that very idea right now within the Indian community, within the color community. There have been protests, you know, against it. Second, now the second issue about the neighboring countries. The neighboring countries that have been economically dependent on South Africa, you know, have a very strong commitment to struggle and justice. And many of the blacks and the whites, who, and a few whites, who have fled South Africa, have gone to the neighboring countries. And South Africa has always bombed these countries, destroyed them, and they have not been able to maintain themselves. So it's like a bully beating down a small, you know, a boy. And after beating down the boy, then we make an agreement that now we'll work together. We agree. It does not mean that the neighboring countries have given up the struggle, no. But they also have to survive and live. So the compact is its expediency on a political and economic level, but it does not alter their commitment to justice, nor do, and we see how the power struggle is maneuvering to divide and conquer. And it's one way in which they're also trying to destroy the OAU, the Organization for African Unity. The same methods of dividing and conquering all other nations. So it's done not only by South Africa, but also with your CIA here, the British, the French, they are all hand in glove in the same setup. So I don't know what your response is, but that's my response.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, I was in Cape Town in 76, the bulk of the colored population live in Cape Town, and colored people then clearly made it quite clear to the government where the allegiance lie, even though the government has for a long time tried to persuade colored people that their interest might be with the white government. And in 76, colored students rioted, and this, the situation was the same basically as in Soweto, except you didn't have that many people killed. With this new constitution, the Labour Party, from the time they decided to go in with the government, they have not been able to speak. I left the country just after the Labour Party decided to go and travel around the country to try and sell the deal two people. They were basically not allowed to talk anywhere. Meetings were disrupted. There was violence. Even in a city like Durban, where there's a very small coloured population, and people have, there's not been a sort of history of resistance as in Cape Town and Johannesburg. The Labour Party couldn't talk. They were, it's been quite clear that people are opposed to the system. But as the sister said, that there are some people, some coloured and Indian people, who will be, who can be bought over, and whose interests might just, might see monetary, or might believe, particularly older people might believe that maybe this is a way of getting a slice of the cake and changing the cake ultimately better. But if they took it to a referendum, which the government has refused to do, they took it to a referendum, it wouldn't pass. People have been quite adamant about how they feel about the new constitution.
Give much power to the groups that were joining in this tricameral thing. What happens is the president of the state will now have even more power. And it's a consolidation of apartheid as a system, mm-hmm. and it's making it even more fascist, while at the same time cosmetically making us think that it is looking better, and making South Africa's image, of course, look better to the international community. But it's something that, together with the agreement that has been signed with Mozambique, something that in the ANC, as our president said, we should see this as a clarion call to consolidate our struggle, to strengthen our struggle, because the issue is not, it's not the cross-border issues with Mozambique and so forth. The struggle in South Africa is inside South Africa. Umkhonto we SIZwe, which is the military wing of the ANC, is fighting from inside. We have bases inside South Africa. This cross-border issue is an issue to divert us from the real issues of apartheid inside South Africa. And, to make us, look at that rather than look at what's going on inside South Africa. And to actually, election year rhetoric to make us look at the United States and think the United States has been instrumental and things look very good and it's doing something good for Southern Africa. When in fact, you look at the basis for signing the treaty, and you look at who has what to give, and you can actually see that it's really that is not the issue in Southern Africa. And in fact, we look at who's the aggressor in South Africa, and in Southern Africa, and we know that the South African regime has been the aggressor, and we know that the United States has not changed its plans for Southern Africa so that to overthrow the Mozambican government as it's constituted, as well as the Angolan government. Because 2 days ago, you just heard that MNR was widely attacking Mozambique, inside Mozambique. And MNR is the creation of South Africa. Mm-hmm. And in fact, right before these agreements were signed, South Africa was buttressing even more this renegade group of MNR. So that we should, MNR is the movement for Mozambican national resistance, which was started by the South Africans using some of the so-called dissidents.
Just like CIA is doing it in Nicaragua and doing it in El Salvador. The other thing I just want to share is all that we have shared here, according to South African law, it is treason. It is treasonable, punishable by death. And it's not an easy thing for us to share here. And some of you may never even meet some of us again. But we have paid a very heavy price to do this. And we want to live too. We want happiness. But we cannot accept happiness in slavery. We can rather have our poverty in freedom and liberty and determine our own destiny. And this is the price that some of us pay. We've lost families, we've lost relatives, and even here we can't get our papers fixed because of who we are and what we stand for. And meetings like this. And that will not stop us, never!
reached our time limit. Want to thank again.
Sorry, just 1 second. Maybe you can mention. I forgot to mention something, that this is the year of women.
Yes.
That it's been declared.
Okay. Well, once you're not.
Yeah,
I forgot something extremely important. That 1984 has been declared the year for South African women, South African and Namibian women, by the United Nations, at the request of the African National Congress. And it is a year where we hope to galvanize and strengthen the role of women within the organization. And we hope that you will participate in the rallying around this year of women, where there'll be many events. And of course, you know that August 9th is the Women's Day, International Women's Day, and that we should, you know, in your respective groups, whatever groups that exist, we hope that you will try to coordinate with the African National Congress Women's Section to have commemorative events for August 9th, and to have maybe even, you know, conferences that revolve around the issue of women in South Africa. Thank you.
There's one more announcement before people go, and I'll be very brief, but I think that most of us have probably been very inspired by people who have been involved in the struggle against apartheid firsthand and on the front lines. But I think, as Sister Chibaku pointed out, it's very important for us to make personal decisions about how we can lend support to that struggle. And on this campus in particular, I don't know how many people here are affiliated with Columbia, but there's been a struggle for the past 2 years to demand that this university divest the $44 million it currently has invested in companies that do business in South Africa. I'm the co-chairperson of the Coalition for Free South Africa at Columbia, and we've been kind of spearheading that struggle. So I think that that would be one way that people who are on this campus, either as faculty or staff or as students, could lend some support to the anti-apartheid struggle that's going on here. Because the U.S. companies that Columbia and other such institutions have investments in are profiting from the kind of slavery and oppression and exploitation that exists in South Africa. And I think it's our duty to demand that kind of economic support discontinues. So I have a list here, a sign-up sheet, if people want to get on the mailing list of Coalition for Free South Africa, and we'll send you some literature. Thank you.
At some point.
Is, just give me your name as you would want to be identified on the air.
Thabisile Ndaba. Of the African National Congress Women's Section, New York. I'm a student at Columbia.
Okay. If you could just speak a little about the Accords and the impact that they have had on the struggle within the borders of Southern Africa, and has it, as the government would have wished, subverted any of the movement because, you know, it affects the bases in Mozambique?
First of all, you know, in terms of bases in Mozambique, it's true that people have gone through Mozambique as a transit area, but it's not true that we've had any bases inside Mozambique. In fact, if we were to characterize the residences of the ANC cadre in Mozambique as military bases, then we could characterize the houses of 1.5 million South Africans inside white South Africans inside South Africa as military bases, because there happens to be guns in every that are carried by 1.5 million whites inside South Africa, and if ANC people have guns to protect themselves within their compounds, and that constitutes a military base, then the regime has to be very clear in telling us so, because then that means that the houses of the 1.5 million whites in South Africa are military bases. However, the signing of the accords, as our president said, was for Mozambique a choice between life and death, and they chose life, which we would all recommend. We would never recommend that our comrades commit suicide, national suicide. However,
you could explain a little bit more about that. In other words, why it was a life and death situation.
The economy inside the country in Mozambique had been
destroyed by elements that were trained and supported by the South African regime, and the South African regime using the pretext that there were ANC bases and this issue of hot pursuit and attacking Mozambique on very many occasions, to the point where the economy was being sabotaged. And the drought inside Mozambique itself did not help as a natural phenomenon. And therefore, there have been many problems that the Mozambicans could not afford to be carrying on a war and spending much of their budget on war when the people of Mozambique themselves were starving because of the drought and because of the economic destabilization and sabotage by the South African regime. So in that sense, they chose life instead of death. And you know, in terms of the people of South Africa, there's an interesting quote that came from the newspapers in South Africa. The people are saying, well, the New York Times put this right, wrote this down, that the people are saying, well, you know, why South Africa is so willing to talk to Samora Machel, a black leader, and is not willing at all inside its borders to talk with Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And this is, in fact, is saying that the people are saying that the issue is not outside, the issue is inside South Africa, and South Africa is skirting the issue, is not dealing with the issue that it really has to deal with inside South Africa. And in fact, we are going to see an even more a greater awakening amongst our people in terms of the struggle, and we are going to see a consolidation, as our president said, that this is a clarion call, it is a challenge to us inside South Africa to consolidate ourselves and to fight harder, to mobilize the people, as this is the year of women, to mobilize women as workers and to mobilize them into the struggle, into the military wing, Umkhonto weSizwe, and to face up to the challenge that the Boers have put to us, and that to also make sure that the international community is very clear on this issue, that the issue of apartheid is the issue in Southern Africa, that without apartheid, there would be no state of war and no state of destabilization, because the destabilizing force is South Africa itself because of its racist apartheid system, which all of Africa is opposed to and will remain opposed to whether there are agreements signed or not, because that is the issue. And as the OAU has also said, and as our president Oliver Tambo said, that is the issue that we have to fight, and that is the only thing that will bring peace to South Africa, to Southern Africa and Africa as a whole, is the total overthrow of the South African regime. And we remain committed to that, and we see that the challenge before us is bigger, it has been raised to higher levels, and that we are capable of raising our struggle to higher levels, and we have shown that we can do so in the past few weeks, where we have seen a few incidences of Umkhonto weSizwe making itself felt within the country, in spite of the fact that they say that they have closed down our bases, because we had no bases in Mozambique.
Switching to another subject here, is a large majority of African women organized in South Africa?
They have no choice but to be organized, because you know, the majority of our women are in the Bantu stands. And the oppression in South Africa is felt throughout. There is the hunger that people experience, the disease that people experience in the Bantustans is nothing but a direct result of the apartheid laws. And our people know that. They know that they are a dispossessed people, they are disenfranchised people, and most of them are people that have been deported from the urban areas into the rural areas.
Most of them?
most of the population now in the Bantustans is the population of people that are being uprooted from the you know urban areas into the rural areas, and even if they have been living in the rural areas, women have always understood, as you know, we have seen it since 1956. That spirit has not died, the spirit of 1956, where peasant women were united together with their, you know, educated sisters and people living in the urban areas to fight apartheid. That spirit has not died because apartheid has not gone away. So the as long as the issue remains, the spirit of the people will remain the same. And as the apartheid regime is strengthening apartheid, therefore we must also strengthen our counter-offensive against the system of apartheid. And that is what is happening amongst the women in rural areas. In fact, you know, women are joining more and more into workers' movements. They're joining more and more the community organizations. There are women's groups being started, self-help groups, and such groups. And in fact, you know, the start of the United Democratic Front has in fact prompted even more community involvement that is anti-apartheid. And so we see this as a growth for the movement, and we see this as strengthening the movement, because women have always played a very strong role as a catalyst and as leaders most of the time in the struggle where our liberation is concerned.
And the white woman who was in the film, is she unusual in South Africa, or are there other white women who are actually joining the struggle?
Helen Joseph is a great woman, you know. She's a woman of great strength. She's not necessarily very unusual. We've had women like Ruth First, who was killed in Mozambique by the South African regime, which sent her a letter bomb inside in Mozambique, where she was teaching. She was a scholar and worked with the New Age, which was a very progressive newspaper inside South Africa, and wrote copiously on the issue of apartheid, and served, I think, 117 days in prison, and she wrote a book on that. And you know, we have other women, white women, that are in this struggle.
See, because I'm trying to figure out, though, I mean, is it a concern of many white women in South Africa in terms of their own freedom?
See, the women's struggle in South Africa is really the one that has pioneered interracial work. The Federation of South African Women was a very large movement, and it had a lot of members that were not black and were either white, these were said to be communists by the white regime. So when in 1950, you know, they banned the Communist Party and put it under all sorts of restrictions, the, you know, some women were intimidated and so forth, but still, you know, that the strength of the bond between our black and white sisters has been very strong, to the point where we can say that the women's movement, you know, the Federation of South African Women in South Africa, has really played a pioneering role in showing and leading the people to a struggle that is both for equal rights as women, but a struggle that is not divorced from the struggle of black liberation.
It describes
that the role that Polaroid and IBM form in the past laws, you know, that the Polaroid takes the pictures and IBM catalogs and the data and that kind of thing.
And there is information right now where American companies are offering technical assistance to the military in South Africa, you know, with all your computer machinery is being used for the military. And tell me which country is fighting South Africa. South Africa is not fighting any country outside. There's an internal thing held by outside forces. So unfortunately, I don't have the company's names right now here. But one thing that you might need to realize is that the United States is a latecomer to South Africa. We were colonized by the Portuguese, we were explorers, and then the Germans and the French, and then the British fought them, and we became a colony under...
The United States opposed all of that because they didn't have a peace.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we were under the British as a colony. Imagine that a tiny island hoarding and capturing people. But what was I going to say? Your question on...
About the involvement of foreigners in the...
Yeah. What I was trying to share was, so obviously these countries that have been in South Africa for a longer period have their companies, German companies, Italian, British, French, Flemish, you name them. But do you know that United States, even though it's a late comer to South Africa, has over 300 companies operating in South Africa, a country that claims to be a democracy that upholds justice, you know, and they're all milking us, our own nation. And I speak as a committed Christian, a trained minister of the church with a master's degree in divinity, that I cannot compromise with evil, I cannot compromise with injustice anywhere. And where there is selfishness anywhere in the world or racism, I have to speak out, and that's what my religious conviction stands for. And you cannot be a religious person if you thrive on misery of other people, on the ignorance of other people, on the powerlessness of other people, on the prejudice. So anybody in this country who claims to be religious and does nothing against injustice in this country and everywhere is a fool, is a hypocrite.
Okay, you're a divinity student in Christianity?
Yes, I am.
How do you feel about that, since it was missionaries who helped colonize Africa in the first place?
Now, first and foremost, we have to recognize that the Christian faith is far more African-Asian than Caucasian. And this is what the Western world does not project.
Really?
Yes, this is a fact. We have right now two living popes. Do you know that? Yes. There is Pope Shenouda III of the Coptic Church. And the Times magazine of 1980 stated that the Coptic Church was the oldest, not old or older, but the oldest living organized Christian community in the world. And just founded by St. Mark, who is in the Bible, in the first century. You know, we forget that Africanness about it. We forget that even when Jesus was born, after he was presented to the temple, and his life was threatened, of all the countries in the world, the only safe place for Mary and Joseph, baby Jesus, was in Africa. They fled to Egypt, which is not in the Middle East, but in Africa. Even the only human being who carried the cross of Christ was a black man. So the white people who are late converts to the Christian faith come across projecting themselves as the bearers of the good news.
Right.
And they have misused it to exploit people, to exploit people. And they have used religion to make people to be docile, to be senile, to be concerned about the world hereafter, when they are involved in the here and now.
So my point is the translation of Christianity that helped colonize Africa, and not Christianity itself.
The misuse. And if you look at the history of that faith, you find that anybody who claims to be a Christian is supposed to be non-sexist, non-racist, and communal in resources, in gifts. So that's the fallacy of the Western world. They cannot claim to be Christians. So Africans have always been religious people, long before the white people were even civilized. We have always believed in one supreme God, and we have a right to choose whatever faith we want to embrace as individuals. So that's where I stand, and that's why I chose. But I'm an eclectic. I do not put down other faiths. nor do I have any problems people don't have a faith. In fact, I get along much better with people who don't profess a faith,
yes,
because they're not so bigoted as the religious people who are largely responsible for the violence throughout the world. Yeah.